Hello, it's Tuesday the 18th of January and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. North Korea has stated that the missiles launched on Monday were of tactical guided missiles. Meanwhile, South Korea has described recent provocations as a direct and serious military threat. We'll have more details shortly. A recent study in the UK has found adoption of COVID-19 vaccine passports could raise a vaccination uptake, but not in countries with high vaccination rates already. We'll speak to one of the authors of the study to find out more. And then coming up for Touch Base in Seoul, we'll speak to Kelsey Payne, the American volleyball player, tearing up the Korean V-League this year. We'll have all that and more on today's Korea 24. North Korea says its fourth missile test of the year, conducted on Monday, was a test of its tactical guided missiles. In response, the South Korean military issued a strongly worded consternation, saying the series of launches poses a direct and serious military threat against the South. For more on this and the rest of the day's key headlines, we have KBS World Radio news editor Eunice Kim joining us on the line today. Eunice, hello.
Hello, Jang-ho.
First off, tell us what North Korean state media had to say on Monday's missile launch. What did we learn?
Well, it was a fairly brief four-paragraph report carried by the KCNA, and it said a test fire of tactical guided missiles was conducted on Monday under a plan of the Academy of Defense Science, the Second Economy Commission, and other concerned institutions. It did not give much specifics on the missile test itself, only to say a pair of tactical guided missiles were launched in the western area of North Korea and had precisely hit an island target in the East Sea of Korea. It added that the Economy confirmed the accuracy, security, and efficiency of the operation of the weapon system under production. So that verbiage would suggest that North Korea is developing a new type of missile, though pundits say a related photo carried by Nodong Shinmun indicates the missiles are likely to be KN-24 short-range ballistic missiles. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un did not attend this latest test.
And as analysis continues on the South Korean side with its allies, the Defense Ministry has issued a strongly worded statement. Can you tell us more?
Right. It expressed concern that at North Korea's latest series of missile launches, assessing them that they are meant to serve as a direct and serious military threat against South Korea. Defense Ministry spokesperson Poo Seung-chan made that statement in a Tuesday briefing, stressing that South Korea is capable of detecting and intercepting North Korean missiles. Meanwhile, the United Nations, its spokesperson, also called North Korea's tests increasingly concerning on Monday, adding they are another reminder of the need for all parties to return to talks to defuse tension and promote a verifiable denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Asked if the UN could establish a dialogue channel to resolve the North Korean nuclear issue, the spokesperson said that channel already exists, adding that the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres supports this diplomatic framework, which should be utilized.
Despite these missile tests occurring at the doorstep of the Beijing Winter Olympics, China has saved its words, instead indicating it understands North Korea's position.
Right. China's foreign ministry spokesperson in a Monday briefing said that there are, quote-unquote, reasons for the situation on the Korean Peninsula being what it is, though he did not elaborate further. He indicated that China will continue to watch reaction from related parties as he hoped for a political solution to the problem. Now, if we rewind a bit to review Beijing's response after North Korea's first, second, and third missile tests of the year so far, it said that sanctions are not helpful in resolving issues and that the concerned parties should not make hasty judgments or react aggressively. So observers are taking these latest remarks from the foreign ministry spokesperson to confirm that there is no change in China's stance when it comes to North Korea amid these heightened tensions from Pyongyang's provocations, if not reaffirming its strategic embrace. Now, in the same Monday briefing, the spokesperson also confirmed that cargo train operations with the North has resumed between Dandong and Sinuiju after friendly talks were held between the two countries. He added it will help normalize their trade relations.
Let's move on to our COVID situation here at home. The government says it's mulling ways to widen the scope of people eligible for an exception from its COVID-19 pass system, with revisions to come soon. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, it seems health authorities are reacting to criticism over the COVID pass system that has been getting louder. Senior Health Ministry official Son Yongle in a radio interview on Tuesday saying that an announcement on how the government will widen that scope of people eligible for the exception to the pass requirement is likely to come before the end of the week. He said the KDCA is reviewing with experts ways to expand the scope, which has been criticized by some as being too narrow. Currently, people who are granted those exemptions include those coming out of isolation after recovering from COVID, those who have been prohibited from getting their second vaccine shot because they had an adverse reaction to their first, as well as people who cannot be vaccinated due to immune deficiency or because they are taking immunosuppressive drugs. Meanwhile, effective today, the government lifted enforcement of the COVID pass at department stores, large discount stores, movie theaters, museums, study rooms, libraries, and cram schools, as we talked about yesterday. While eating will still be restricted at the said places, the system does remain in place at restaurants and coffee shops in general, including those inside department stores and large discount stores.
Meanwhile, where are we in our daily COVID numbers for today?
Well, daily new COVID-19 cases climbed back above 4,000 on Tuesday, and South Korea's cumulative caseload surpassed the 700,000 mark with that addition. The KDCA said 4,072 new cases were compiled throughout Monday, with 309 of those cases coming from overseas. The number of critically ill patients did fall by 36 to 543. Monday saw 45 COVID-linked deaths, raising the overall death toll to 6,378.
Now, in a bid to encourage more young people to get vaccinated, the government has also unveiled a compensation plan for minors. Can you tell us more?
Right. This was presented by the Education Minister, Yoon Hae. She announced a COVID-19 support plan for students, which includes a maximum 5 million won compensation and medical fee assistance for students under 18 who show serious side effects within 90 days after vaccination but did not receive national compensation. It also addresses anxiety or depression from the prolonged pandemic. Students at high risk of self-harm or suicidal tendencies can receive up to 3 million won for treatment of physical conditions and up to another 3 million won for treatment of mental diagnoses. The ministry said it will also offer psychological support for students who have tested positive or have recovered from the virus.
To the presidential campaign trail next, we're now 50 days to Election Day, and we thought we had a date for the first one-on-one debate between Lee Jae-myung and Yoon Suk-yeol, the main two contenders, but the details are still being worked out, it seems.
Yeah, earlier in the day, the ruling Democratic Party's lawmaker Park Chun-min, who's also a member of the party's election committee, had said a two-hour debate was agreed upon with the country's three terrestrial broadcasters, KBS, MBC, and SBS, that will be broadcast from 10 p.m. on January 27th, that is just before the Lunar New Year holiday. But later in the afternoon, the main opposition People Power Party said the time and date has not been agreed, counter-proposing January 31st, the first day of the holiday as a better option. It also said the broadcast should be during the golden TV hours of between 6 and 10 p.m. as opposed to starting the two-hour debate at 10 p.m. Meanwhile, the DP candidate Lee Jae-myung is said to have accepted the broadcaster's proposal to have another debate that would include the two minor party candidates, Ahn Cheol-soo and Shim Sang-jung, which is set to happen sometime after the Lunar New Year holiday. That is, of course, if everything is agreed upon by all parties.
Let's get a quick update on President Moon Jae-in's visit to the Middle East. He's moved on to the second country of his three-nation tour, but before leaving for Saudi Arabia, he had a phone call with the UAE's Crown Prince.
Right. You'll remember their summit talks had to be canceled due to, quote unquote, unforeseen and urgent matters of state on the UAE side. So in place, President Moon Jae-in had phone talks with Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan on Monday. Presidential spokesperson Park Young-mi said that during the 25-minute conversation, President Moon said that although he did not get to meet the Crown Prince in person, he did extend his gratitude for the warm hospitality shown by the UAE Prime Minister to the South Korean delegation. He also expressed condolences to the victims of a deadly drone attack on a key oil facility and the international airport in Abu Dhabi on Monday. Claimed by the Yemen's Houthi rebels, the attack did kill three people. Now, in Saudi Arabia, President Moon is set to meet with de facto ruler Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Riyadh on the occasion of 60 years of their diplomatic ties. The visit does mark the first time in 7 years for a South Korean leader to visit Saudi Arabia.
That will be all for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates, Eunice.
You bet.
In South Korea, starting today, a COVID-19 pass is no longer required for entry into department stores, large discount stores, movie theatres, museums, libraries and cram schools. These six types of locations are considered to hold a low risk of infection. While the latest measure has stirred up controversy over which facilities should be deemed low risk, an interesting study from the UK has shown that such a vaccine passport system could increase vaccination uptake, but in countries where vaccination rate is already high, there is no significant effect. To learn more about these findings, we're joined on the line now by the study's co-author, Tobias Rutenauer, postdoctoral prize research fellow in sociology at the University of Oxford. Dr. Rutenauer, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Can you first introduce us to this study that you co-authored titled The Effect of Mandatory COVID-19 Certificates on Vaccine Uptake? Which countries did you look at and what were you looking for?
Yes, so we did a study basically where we used six mainly European countries that introduced COVID certificates, and we compared them to 19 other countries that did not introduce COVID certificates. And so what we basically found here is that, well, we basically tried to estimate what would have happened in countries if they would not have implemented these measures, and then we compared it to what we actually observed after they introduced these measures.
Okay.
And what we observed here is, for instance, like in countries like France, Italy, or Israel that introduced COVID certificates, we saw that already after the announcement of introducing the certificates, vaccination uptake increased significantly afterwards and remained relatively high for around 4 weeks after the introduction of these certificates. So we basically have a daily vaccination increase of around 20% due to this implementation of COVID certificates in these countries.
Right. So when a country decides to adopt a COVID-19 certificate, vaccine uptake goes up then?
Yes, exactly. I mean, the thing is that we had some differences between countries. So we saw the strongest effect in France, Israel, and Italy. And those were basically countries that before they implemented these certificates, they had relatively low daily vaccination rates. So they were below what we would have expected based on other countries in Europe. And when they introduced these certificates, they increased the vaccine uptake. But that also somehow indicates that, well, for countries like, for instance, Germany was another case that we looked at. And Germany had a relatively average vaccination uptake before they introduced these certificates. And there we could not see a significant increase in vaccinations after the introduction of the certificates. So it somehow seems that, these measures are more effective when we introduce them at countries that have a below average vaccination rate before the introduction of the certificates.
So basically with, for example, South Korea currently has a completed vaccination rate of almost 85% of the entire population, and 46% have received a booster shot as well. That would be considered a high vaccination rate in your model then?
Definitely. I mean, the vaccination rate in South Korea is much higher than in most European countries, right? I mean, we are talking about Germany was around like 60% vaccination rate back then. So the vaccination rates were much lower than they are right now in South Korea, for instance.
So therefore, extrapolating from that, adoption of a vaccine certificate system here will not help raise the vaccination rate further then?
Well, I think that, the vaccine certificates are in place for some time, right? And I think that they might have been one of the reasons why vaccination uptake in South Korea is so high. And I think they might have helped in increasing vaccination uptake. But I think at the point where we have around 90% being vaccinated, the question is how helpful the certificates are in getting the remaining 10%, right? Mm. And I think here the question is probably, what is the reason why these 10% are not vaccinated? And I think usually what we saw here in the UK is, for instance, that those who are not vaccinated, like a large proportion, does not have very strong feelings against getting vaccinated. They just feel like, well, they don't feel a need to get the vaccine because they think they're young, they don't need to be protected and things like that. And I mean, for them, I think that these certificates somehow like increase the incentives of getting the vaccine because it's easier to get into venues and it's easier to meet friends and so on. And that somehow is an additional incentive to get the vaccine, even if you think you're not personally at a high risk of contracting the virus or of getting strong symptoms. But I mean, the question is there are also like some people who feel very strongly that they don't want to get the vaccine. And I mean, if we only have 10% left, it might be that this is mainly a group of like having strong feelings and that maybe in this group, the vaccine certificates are not as effective as they are among a larger group where we have more people who don't have that strong feelings about vaccinations.
Right. In a report on your study on the Oxford University website, you were quoted as saying that certification alone is not a silver bullet for improving vaccine uptake and it must be used alongside other policies. And that sounds like what you're just saying there then as well.
Yes, definitely. I mean, the thing is, well, the UK, for instance, is also a bit of a specific case because we have such strong differences in demographics of vaccinations. So what we see here is, for instance, that the vaccination rates among immigrant and ethnic minorities are much lower than they are among the majority group. And we also see that vaccination rates in areas with high levels of economic deprivation deprived areas, we have lower vaccine uptake. And so I think that another measure or other measures that one would need to consider here is basically to somehow like get in touch with those people, like think about why these people don't get the vaccine. And I think that one main problem here is that in these groups, the trust into the government might be lower. And that's why I think that somehow having something like a community dialogue, talking to people, giving them information might also be helpful in increasing vaccination rates in these communities. And obviously another thing is when we talk about deprived areas, the access to vaccination might be lower, right? I mean, it might be that distances to vaccination centers are higher, that people don't have their own cars, they have to take public transport or have difficulties in general to reach these centers. And so I think that something like vaccine drives or pop-up centers that somehow try to offer vaccination geographically close to these groups might also be more helpful in these communities.
I mentioned earlier that South Korea has decided to differentiate between low-risk and high-risk facilities. What do you make of that sort of decision? Does that perhaps undermine how people might view the necessity for a vaccine pass?
This is hard to say, but I think that to some extent, to me, it makes sense to make this differentiation. Because as I said earlier, I mean, one might differentiate between two aims of these vaccine certificates, right? I mean, the first aim would be that we increase vaccine uptake. And as you said, I mean, Korea has a very high vaccination rate, and so this aim might already be achieved in South Korea, and that's why maybe vaccine passports are not that helpful anymore in increasing vaccine uptake.
Mm.
But obviously a secondary aim of vaccination certificates is that they might make specific venues safer in terms of reducing the risk of transmission.
Mm.
And I think that there are some indications that, for instance, places like bars, pubs, and restaurants might pose a relatively high risk of contracting the virus. And restricting access with COVID certificates might make them safer and reduce the risk of spreading COVID in these venues. While I guess that other venues, as you said, I mean, maybe department stores, I mean, the research is not entirely clear there, but I mean, the risk might in general be lower there, and that's why maybe we don't really need these certificates in these venues if we have already a high vaccination uptake rate in the country.
Okay, looking overall then, how important and necessary could COVID-19 certification be for a country? When do you think is the right time to implement COVID-19 certificates?
Well, I mean, again, this probably comes back to the aim, right? I think that if you want to increase vaccination rates, then I think the optimal timing would have been to implement them early during this pandemic, or like, let's say, in the like at some point during last year that we had like where we had still relatively low vaccination rates, and where we somehow needed some kind of like incentive to increase vaccination rates. If these certificates also help to reduce transmission in venues, I mean, obviously, then also during a period of high COVID cases, they might be helpful in preventing the health system to be overwhelmed, and they might be helpful in reducing the COVID rates in a country. But I think that the research on how effective certificates are in reducing COVID infections and COVID rates, that is by now somehow unclear. So we don't have very convincing studies that show, well, they really reduce the number of COVID cases in a country. But that is more of a data problem rather than that it might be a problem of the certificate itself.
And finally, how would you advise policymakers that are considering a COVID-19 certification or that have perhaps issues with COVID-19 certification?
Well, I think there are several things to consider here. And I mean, one thing that we have seen across countries is in our study, we saw that already the announcement of these certificates were quite effective in increasing vaccine uptake. And I think like one practical advice would be that if countries introduce these measures, they should somehow like make sure that they let some time between the announcement and the actual introduction of these measures. And to somehow like announce this as a strong measure that everyone is aware that there will be these vaccine passports, and that already creates an incentive of getting vaccinated, right? But then on the other hand, I think another issue that obviously might or that must be considered here is that obviously these vaccine passports also have a potential of increasing inequality because they are restricting access to specific venues for specific groups. And as I said earlier, for instance, we have like lower vaccination rates among immigrants and ethnic minorities here in the UK. And so restricting their access to specific venues might somehow further increase inequalities, and that might also somehow lead to a further spiral in lowering trust of these groups in the government, right? And so I think it's somehow important to consider that we also prevent strong inequalities between groups when we introduce these vaccination certificates.
Well, Dr. Rutenau, we appreciate you walking us through your findings today and for answering all of our questions. We've been speaking to Dr. Tobias Rutenau from the University of Oxford. Thank you once again for your time.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 25.86 points or 0.89% on Tuesday, closing the day at 2,864.24. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 13.96 points or 1.46% to close at 943.94. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 2.6 won against the dollar, ending the day at 1,190.1 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We continue on now to Korea Trending, our daily segment where we find out what other news stories people in Korea have been looking up online today. And with those stories for us today is Jung Yewon, who's joined us now in the studio. Yewon, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello.
Okay, so what topics do you have for us today?
First, we'll delve into research conducted on the efficacy of a fourth dose against the Omicron variant. Next, we'll talk about an adult male ski instructor being booked for sexually assaulting an underage girl. And finally, we'll learn how South Korean literature is really picking up overseas.
Okay, so let's delve into those stories then. We begin with news on the efficacy of a second booster. Can you tell us more?
Yes, a study from Israel is showing that even four doses of the COVID-19 vaccine is not enough to fully prevent people from contracting the Omicron variant. The study was conducted at the Sheba Medical Center in Israel, which is the first country in the world to administer the fourth booster shot, as they began just last month, aimed for vulnerable and high-risk groups. And on Monday local time, the lead researcher, Professor Gili Regev-Yochai, said that the study showed an increase in antibodies larger than after a third dose. However, she said that the researchers still saw many infected with Omicron who received a fourth dose.
Right. We, in fact, spoke to a doctor from the Sheba Medical Center earlier this month as they were just starting the extra booster rollout for high-risk groups. But it looks like it has been ineffective against the Omicron variant then. Can you tell us a bit more about what they found exactly?
Yes, of course. So last month, the medical center administered a fourth vaccine to more than 270 medical workers, and some 150 received a fourth dose of Pfizer, while 120 received a fourth dose of Moderna. And all had been previously vaccinated with three doses of Pfizer, and the control group consisted of those who didn't receive a fourth dose. And Professor Regev-Yochai went on to say that the findings are just preliminary, but she's showing early results as there is a high public interest in the matter.
I see, that is disappointing. But despite these early findings, I understand that it hasn't stopped Israel's fourth dose initiative.
Yeah, that's right. So as of Sunday night local time, over 500,000 people were inoculated with a fourth dose. And last month, Israel's health ministry began offering a fourth dose to Israelis 60 and older, the immunocompromised, and medical workers. But as the professor said, it is too early to officially draw any solid conclusions from the study as it's still in its initial stage.
I see. South Korea is still mulling over the possible rollout of a fourth shot, but it looks like these findings might deter the health authorities. Meanwhile, Pfizer and Moderna have both said that they've developed an Omicron-specific vaccine and that it will be coming out this year. So perhaps those new vaccines will be the way forward rather than a second booster, but we'll have to wait and see for now. Okay, let's move on to our next story. What do you have for us?
The Gangwon Provincial Police Agency announced Monday that they booked a 25-year-old male ski instructor on charges of sexually assaulting a minor. And according to the police report, last Christmas, the man allegedly took a sixth-grade girl to an unmanned motel and raped her. And the man had reportedly asked some male students who worked part-time at the ski rental shop to introduce him to the girl when he saw a picture of her.
Right. I understand that the young girl only just recently gave a statement on her accounts of the event. Can you tell us what she told the police? And sadly, I'd like to warn our listeners that some might find some of the details distressing.
Yes, so in her statement, the girl received a call from an older male student acquaintance. However, it was the ski instructor that spoke through the line who said that he was going to pick her up for a party. and some 30 minutes later, he indeed pulled up in front of her house. And when they arrived to the motel, the man offered her some alcohol and asked if she wanted to engage in prostitution. But when the girl pleaded to leave, the man threatened her that he would beat her up if she continued to resist him. And the sexual assault went on until 1 a.m., according to the girl. However, the man continued to assault her in the vehicle as they left the motel, and he didn't let her go until 2 a.m. in the morning. And the girl didn't immediately go to her parents, but confided in a close friend the following day, prompting the police to begin their investigation.
The case is ongoing, of course, but that is a very harrowing and disturbing account, which is why there's been some public uproar after it was found that the instructor had been let go by the police after he was brought in for questioning.
Right. So the police put him under emergency arrest, but he was released soon after as there was no statement from the alleged victim at the time. Meanwhile, the ski instructor went to the police and actively denied all allegations made against him. And the man in question is still currently working as a ski instructor and has been declining to comment when contacted by local media outlets, directly sending them to his attorney.
Yes, of course, we cannot make judgments until the case is fully investigated and gone through the courts, but questions are being raised about whether he should have been allowed to continue teaching while the case is still open. That is understandably causing some concern and controversy. Okay, let's move on to our last story for today. What do you have for us?
South Korean author Cho Nam-ju's novel Kim Ji-young, born 1982, has been the best-selling work of Korean literature abroad for the past 5 years. In its recent survey, the Literature Translation Institute of South Korea, LTI Korea for short, announced that between 2016 and 2020, more than 300,000 copies of Kim Ji-young, born 1982, were sold in 10 languages. And in particular, it established itself as a steady seller in Japan, selling more than 200,000 copies since its publication in the country in 2018. The survey was conducted on 658 Korean literature pieces that were published overseas in 36 different languages.
Right, the book was a big hit in Korea as well, of course, although also controversial for being labelled a feminist work. Mm-hmm. But as much as the book sparked debate in Korea, looks like that's also led to its wide interest overseas as well. Now, going back to that survey and the organisation that carried it out, LTI Korea, they are a huge supporter for the translation and publication of Korean literature. We've also talked about them often on our show for our weekly segment, Korea Book Club. I understand that this survey showed a growing interest in Korean literature around the world.
Absolutely. So with support from LTI Korea, South Korean literature published abroad has been growing at an average annual rate of 10% since 2017. And works such as Kim Ji-young, born 1982, or Almond, which became bestsellers or steady sellers in certain countries, are also being published in multiple languages and also seeing a high number of sales. And in fact, the survey we just discussed revealed that 34 such works have sold over 5,000 copies each. And this trend shows that South Korean literature has firmly established its stance in the global literature and publishing market. In fact, 80% of overseas publishers apply for Korean literature translation and publication. And in regards to this, LTI Korea said that now it can be seen that local literature is at the beginning of the literary Korean wave.
Right. What other notable works have been involved in this wave, according to the survey?
Right, so author Han Gang's The Vegetarian sold over 160,000 copies in 13 languages, and Sun Wonpyeong's Almond sold over 90,000 copies just in Japan, and the Portuguese version of Chun Yu-jung's Origin of Species, published in 9 languages, has sold more than 20,000 copies in Brazil.
Yes, and hopefully there'll be more successful works to come in the future. That's where we'll wrap it up for today's Korea Trending. Yeowon, thank you for those stories, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Great, thank you.
In the Women's Pro Volleyball League in Korea, Kimchon Korea Expressway High Pass has been on an impressive run. The team currently sits second in the league, and at one point they recorded 12 consecutive victories. At the heart of his team is American Kelsey Payne, our guest today for Touch Base in Seoul. The Austin, Texas native, also known as the Payne Train, has played all over the world and has now solidified herself as a force to be reckoned with in South Korea in her second season with High Pass. To tell us more about her story, she joins us on the line now. Ms. Payne, hello and welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
As I mentioned, High Pass is having quite the season, and so are you, it seems. I know you're one of the highest scorers in the league, and you won the third round MVP as well. I'm guessing you must be really enjoying the season at the moment.
Yeah, for sure. It's been going really well, so I'm just happy with how we're doing so far.
Yes, well, we'll talk more about the current season in a bit, but we wanted to get to know your story a bit more as well. So as you mentioned, you're from the US. I understand that you had quite a sporty family. Were you always an athletic person? And how did you get into the world of volleyball?
Oh, I think so. So I have two brothers. And growing up, my older brother always was playing soccer, basketball, literally everything. And so I was just kind of getting dragged around to his games. And once I got to like 7 or 8, I was like, okay, like, I think I want to try. So I've played pretty much every sport, and I think my parents just always supported me, so that made it super easy to get into.
So you're trying at every sport then. How did you get into volleyball?
I started when I was 11, and honestly, I just did it because my friends were doing it. I didn't really know much about it, but my friends were like, we're going to go try out for like our middle school team if you want to go, and I was like, yeah, like I want to hang out. So I did it, and I fell in love with it like right away.
What was it about it that you loved? What worked for you playing volleyball?
I think the team aspect of it, honestly, I think it's one of the few sports that really like relies on each other because like you can't contact the ball more than, you know, once in a row. So you really need the people around you and just how fun it is and how fast paced, and obviously being tall helps me a lot. So it's fun.
So you were enjoying playing volleyball at a young age. When did you realize that you perhaps had what it took to become a professional athlete? And was that an easy transition to make?
I think I was maybe 15 or 16. I had a coach who really helped me a lot. She saw the potential in me. And from that age, she was like, you know, you have a lot of talent. And if you work hard, like it's not going to come easy. But if you put in the work, like I think you can be really great. So she was super influential and she just worked with me. And I think at that point I realized like, okay, like if I really want to do this, like now is the time to start working towards it. So yeah, probably 15 or 16.
From there, how was it becoming a professional? Was it a difficult path or did you find it quite easy for you?
Definitely difficult. So then I had to go through college recruiting. So like in the U.S., you go to play for 4 years and I had to decide on which university. And then from then I switched positions. So I had to deal with that and just different coaches and different styles. So it definitely was not easy, but it was all worth it.
You ended up then traveling quite a bit in your career. Before coming to South Korea, you played overseas in Brazil and Switzerland. What's it been like for you as a professional athlete living in all these places?
Yeah, it's been kind of crazy to think about, but also really awesome. And I'm honored, honestly, that this is my job and I get to go to these cool places and meet so many people. So, I mean, I've been really fortunate and I think it's really cool.
As you were living in all these places, did you miss home or did you just enjoy playing in these leagues?
Definitely homesick. It's not easy being away for 6, 7, 8 months in a row, but my family's super supportive and they come visit me when they can and we phone call and FaceTime. So not easy, but we make it work.
Okay, then in June 2020, you were at a major turning point, at a crossroads, so to speak. You were then signed with a German team, but then your name was announced in Kovo's draft to play for Kimchon High Pass. Can you tell us a bit more about how that happened? What made you decide that you wanted to come to Korea?
Yeah, so I think it was like spring of 2020. I was talking with my agent after my Switzerland season finished, and he was like, hey, you have an option to sign up for the Korean draft, but also like if that doesn't work out, we need to obviously like secure you a job for next season. So We started talking with the team in Schwerin, Germany, and we, you know, wrapped up a contract. I was like, hey, like, I will come play for you guys, but I'm also signed up for the draft. So if I get drafted, like, I will have to go. There's this whole buyout thing. And I got drafted. So, yeah, I had to tell my German team. Unfortunately, I wouldn't be able to play with them. And I came to Korea.
What did you know about the Korean League before you came?
Not a lot. I know there was a few Americans that have played in the league before me, obviously, and I knew a few of them. So I'd heard a few things from them, just like how long it is, how many games and stuff like that. But honestly, I didn't really know much until I got here.
Hmm. And what did you know about Korea, the country, before you came?
Almost nothing. I don't think I knew anyone from here that had been here, personally been here before. So I was super excited, actually, to come and see it for myself.
Right. So you're excited. You weren't perhaps nervous about coming to somewhere you didn't know?
No, I think that's honestly one of the best parts about each season is like just kind of winging it and seeing what I'm going to get myself into. So that's always exciting for me.
Right. So when you first arrived then and started playing, what was that transition like to come to Korea? How was the adjustment?
It was not bad. I think my coaches and teammates are super patient with me. Like, they've had foreign players many years before, so they kind of know how it goes. But just like getting comfortable with obviously like the language and my translator and my teammates, it took maybe a month or two, but once I got into it, everyone was super understanding and we flowed really easily.
What was the most difficult part in the transition? Was it the language?
Yeah, I think so. Because like just not being able to even like read signs or like sound them out. Like in Germany or Brazil, like I could kind of like, okay, that's a P, that's an L. But like here, the symbols are completely different. So I'm totally lost. But having a translator helps a lot. So she helped.
And is that the biggest difference between playing in the other countries that you've played in?
I would say so. That and just like the volume of the league. Like we play a lot more games in a shorter amount of time. So between the language and then the amount that we play, it's definitely the toughest league I think I've played in.
Okay, so tell us more about what you think of the Korean V League. Was it what you expected?
Yeah, I mean, again, I didn't really know what to expect, but from what I heard, it lines up pretty well. I mean, I'm the only foreign player, so I have to carry a lot of weight. Obviously, I'm the only one that has the role that I do, but it's also very rewarding. Like I said, my team's super supportive, and they all want me to play really well, so it feels good to know that they are behind me.
What is it about the Korean V League that perhaps has struck you that you didn't know before? What surprised you about the league?
I think just one of the things that threw me off was that there's only now there's seven teams. Last year was only 16 in the league, so we play each other a lot. Like, we have six rounds with six other teams, so we play each other like every 2 weeks. I feel like we're playing the same team, so that part definitely caught me off guard.
Well, you're well into your second season with High Pass now. How has it been integrating with the squad? I'm guessing with the second year it must be a lot easier.
Yeah, it was super fun coming back. Everyone was excited to see me, and there's a big difference when you can come back to a place that you're familiar with, just like knowing the schedule, knowing where everything is, like just little things like that makes it a lot easier, like mentally. And yeah, I'm thinking with everyone, like everything is pretty seamless now. So it's been good.
As you said, you're sitting second in the league and well on the way to the playoffs. What do you think has been the secret to your team's success this year?
I think we are a lot more confident this year. I think it also comes with just being comfortable. Like, we know each other more, so you know what to expect from each other, and everyone's very trusting, and I don't know, we kind of just have fun. It's not like we're putting a lot of pressure on ourselves, but it's been a good, like, confidence boosting year, I think, so that helps.
And what about for you personally? What kind of year has it been for you? How do you think you've progressed as an athlete?
I think I'm doing well. from last year to this year, I think my numbers have improved, and honestly, again, it's just like a confidence thing. Like I said, we play these teams like every 2 weeks, so that helps too, just knowing your opponent. And I've improved, I think, in every aspect, defense, blocking, attacking. So just being able to know that my team trusts me and they know that I'm able to do these things instills confidence in me. So I think that's why I've improved so much.
And have you adjusted more to life in Korea as well now? Can you perhaps read a little bit of Korean?
I know a few more words. Reading is still not a thing, but I do know, like, hi, bye, thank you, like the very, very basic.
Mm. And how has it been interacting with the fans here in Korea?
So cool. That's the difference between last year, is that we actually have fans in attendance now. So it's been a lot more exciting. I think it's better than playing in, like, an empty gym. And they're so supportive, and they send me lots of messages, and they're always cheering for us, like, outside of our games, and it's been really, really cool.
Is there any difference in the fan culture here in Korea compared to some of the other leagues you played in?
I think the Korean fans are the most passionate about volleyball. Like I said, like, I have videos, but sometimes, like, before our games will pull up, or if we're leaving, there's fans just, like, lining both sides of the bus, like, waving and cheering. Like, I've never personally experienced anything like that. So, yeah, the Korean fans are definitely the most passionate.
Okay, and finally, as we said, you're doing well in the league, but what's your goals for the rest of this season? Do you think you'll be able to take it all the way?
I really hope so. We're playing really well right now. Like you said, we had 12 in a row, lost that streak, but I think in a way it kind of like lifts a little weight off of us so we can kind of just breathe again. But yeah, we have two rounds left, and I think we're well on the way to playoffs if we can keep this up and hopefully make it to championship and win the whole thing.
And if I can ask you one more thing, perhaps a message to the fans out there for High Pass?
Yeah. Thank you so much for all the support these past two seasons. It's really helped me a lot as an athlete, and I know our team really appreciates it. We've been doing really well so far, so hopefully we can keep doing it. So please, please keep cheering for us. You guys are great. Thank you.
Yes, we wish you the best of luck for the rest of the season. We've been speaking to Kelsey Payne of Kimchun Korea Expressway High Pass. Ms. Payne, thank you for your time today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Hello, this is Tiger JK of Drunken Tiger. You're now listening to Korea 24.
We move on now to our final segment of the show, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald, who we thank for providing us with their early editions to make this segment possible. And for that, as usual, we have joining us in the studio now our staff editor, Mark Wilson. Chair, Mark, hello. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Okay, so where are we headed to first?
We head to the culture section of tomorrow's Korea Times. Early on the show, you talked about the Korean literature making a name for itself abroad. But in tomorrow's Times, Kwak Yeon-soo writes about what's being put off the shelves here in South Korea, particularly works that have gained renewed interest due to films based on them. It's according to Kyobo Book Center, the nation's largest bookstore chain. Now, all the examples that Kwak provides aren't strictly Korean, but it does show what local book buyers are gravitating to these days.
Right, so you're saying some of these works have been on the shelves for months or possibly even years,
yeah.
But according to this flagship store, they're in much higher demand following the release of their on-screen adaptions. That makes sense, sure enough. But how much of a jump are we talking about here?
Well, for example, Haruki Murakami's 2014 short story collection, Men Without Women, wasn't even on the store's top 100 sellers list for fiction, drama, and poetry recently. But its on-screen adaptation, Drive My Car, became a pretty big hit, even winning a Golden Globe for Best Picture in the non-English language category. And the book jumped to 33rd in that store. The Japanese film, it did pretty well here in South Korea as well. There's also Joe Sasaki's 2017 crime novel, The Policeman's Lineage. It entered the book chain's top 100 list for the first time ever, garnering much attention for the Korean director Lee Kyu-man's recent film adaptation. Sasaki was completely on board with the film's production, even bringing his book on set to support the cast and telling the cast how excited he was that the work was being adapted. It was really sweet, I think. To learn what else the local readers are pulling off the shelves due to on-screen adaptations, pick up tomorrow's Times.
Yes, I guess it's, as we said, very understandable. It's a fortunate side effect, shall we say, of movie adaptations that they help people rediscover works that they might have missed the first time. Okay, moving on. Where are we headed to next?
So we head to the issue and data section of tomorrow's Korea Herald. It's the first time you and I think we headed to this section, but Yoo Min-sik has an incredibly informative piece that asks, is Korea a tsunami-free zone? Now, earlier this week, you talked about tsunami warnings that were issued after that massive underwater volcano eruption just north of the Tongan capital, remember?
Sure.
Warnings were made all the way up to Japan and all the way out to the U.S.'s west coast. But Yoon writes that such an event triggered people to ask, is South Korea safe? I'm about to move to a house that's about a couple minutes away from the water, and I'd be lying if I didn't say I didn't ask that myself either, right? Now, Yoon explains that it depends. You see, any tsunami originating in the Pacific has to go through Korea's natural barricade, Japan, which blocks a lot of water.
Right, that's what I thought, and I'm sure what many people would have thought as well, that Korea, because Japan is next to it, it forms that barricade through any sort of tsunamis or earthquakes that come from the Pacific. But what about tsunamis that perhaps could originate elsewhere, just next to South Korea, either in the East Sea or waters between us and mainland China?
Right, so Yoon writes that that could occur, but that event would be less common. Since 1900, only four tsunamis originated in the East Sea that caused substantial damage to Korea. Earthquakes, a main cause of tsunamis, are something that happens more often in Korea, of course. And experts say most aren't strong enough to create tsunamis. The Korean Meteorological Administration shows that an earthquake above a magnitude of 6.5 can trigger a dangerous tsunami, but many, they don't go above 3.0. Mm. Some maybe around 5.0, but still not strong enough. Now, this doesn't really put us in a safe zone per se, but Yoon writes that we are in a much less vulnerable spot compared to our neighbors.
Right, so we shouldn't worry, but it still sounds like a quite an interesting article nonetheless.
Good to be prepared.
That's where we'll wrap it up for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for those stories, Mark, and we'll see you next time.
See you then.
And that's where we wrap up our show for today as well. Thanks for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so we hope you do join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.